Hello and welcome to How to Win, the Vandenberg Coalition's series on challenges facing the United States military and Department of Defense in an era of great power competition, heightened tensions, and increasing chaos around the world. Today, we're discussing technology and reforming defense acquisitions. Here to discuss with me is Jamil Jaffer. Jamil is currently a venture partner with Paladin Capital, focusing on dual-use national security technology. He is also the founder and executive director of the National Security Institute at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason. Jamil was also recently appointed by the DHS and CISA to its Cybersecurity Safety Review Board. Prior to these roles, Jamil served as senior business leader at IronNet Cybersecurity. In the Bush administration, Jamil served in the White House as an associate counsel to the president, handling the Department of Defense, State Department, and intelligence community matters, and served as one of the White House counsel's primary representatives to the National Security Council Deputies Committee. Thank you so much for joining me. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thrilled to be here.
So when it comes to technology and its national security uses, it sometimes feels like our strategy is shaped around the capability rather than the capability as a part of strategy enabling us to achieve our desired ends. What do you view the landscape to look like, and how should the United States government be forcing or shaping policy to guide us?
Well, look, as a general matter, as a country, we've always liked and thought that the technology, the business ideas should lead, right? And the government, to the extent that it was an enabler, right, helping with basic research, helping identify difficult problems and identifying core ways of solving those problems, but then leaving it to industry to innovate and develop a commercial capability, that's always been our tradition as a country. It's what's made us so innovative as a culture. It's what's led to the growth of the Silicon Valley out in California, the Silicon Alley in New York, right? Obviously, the Dulles Corridor here in the D.C. metro area. We have tech innovation in this country primarily because the government might enable some of it. The government might prompt some of it through basic science research. But fundamentally, when it comes to technology innovation and development, the government gets out of the way and lets private industry innovate. And so that, to me, is the right approach. Now, that being said, it doesn't mean that we don't believe in this country in industrial policy, or that conservatives don't believe in industrial policy. I consider myself a conservative. We've always had industrial policy. Our defense industrial base is created by U.S. government-funded industrial policy. Our telecommunications system has been funded by industrial policy. So when we think about the U.S. government spending money or investing in areas like semiconductors or artificial intelligence, I'm not that concerned about it as long as it doesn't become the U.S. government picking winners and losers, right? Investing in basic science research, investing in capabilities, investing in infrastructure, to me, is an acceptable and completely historical form of innovation policy and industrial policy. I don't see it as a dirty word for conservatives.
Right. And so we're going to get to AI and semiconductors in a little bit, but I kind of want to speak a little bit more broadly for now. So in the past few years, we've seen a shift in terms of venture capital firms investing more in defense tech startups, and that wasn't necessarily the case before. But at the same time, the Pentagon isn't necessarily buying and investing in these companies. So where and why is there a gap between what the Pentagon says it wants and what it's actually buying? And what should we be doing to kind of prevent this from happening?
Well, it's funny you should ask. I now serve in a venture partner capacity with a dual-use investor in the national security space, Paladin Capital. You know, we invest in this very space, that inner space between national security and commercial capabilities. And one of the challenges, you're exactly right, is that we're finding these great technologies, but then getting the government to adopt them can be hard, right? The government has all sorts of really great programs to start companies off, give them some non-dilutive financing, right, some grants and the like, but then getting them over what's called the valley of death, right, from research and development into actual practice and purchasing at scale by the government has been a real challenge. And so there's no doubt in my mind that the Pentagon wants to innovate. They do innovate at times. The challenge is they're used to buying from big defense contractors. They're used to buying from big companies that have established infrastructure, that have a track record. You know, they apply the DFAR, right, the Defense Acquisition Regulations, right? They apply things like CMMC, which is good because you want cybersecurity in the companies that you buy from. At the same time, when you impose a significant regulatory model, right, on a small company, it's hard for them to develop the innovative product and comply with all your regulatory regime and still bring a product to market. And so that's the real challenge. So it's not that the Pentagon doesn't mean it. They do. It's not that they don't have money to spend on it. They've tried to put money in the Office of Strategic Capital. They put money in DIU, the Defense Innovation Unit. Finally, that entity now, because of congressional action, actually has committed funding. Instead of having to go begging and borrowing from various agencies to get funding, they have their own funding to support startups. So we're seeing a move in the right direction, right? It's not nearly as fast as we would want, as you would want, as I think frankly, the Pentagon would want. But the moves are we're moving in the right direction. And in the long run, I think the trend is towards innovation in acquisition as well. But you got to fix the core rules, and that's the hard part.
Right. So while we're still in a, you know, we're still in a cycle in which the defense acquisition cycles favor single-use products, where are the areas that the CCP could exploit this favoring of single-use technology?
Well, look, I mean, the Chinese Communist Party, when they think about what they're targeting, whether it's them or our other adversaries in Russia or Iran or China, they recognize that collection on our defense capabilities, right, and on those innovative technologies is beneficial to them both from a national security perspective, so you understand what our Defense Department is looking to buy, the capabilities underlying it, but they also recognize from an economic perspective. So, you know, the Chinese government at scale has engaged in the largest transfer of wealth in modern human history. That's what General Keith Alexander called it a decade ago, and he was right, and he's right today. The FBI director repeated that phrase just about a year and a half ago, right? Because the Chinese government is actually taking tremendous amounts of innovation out of U.S. industry, some of it government funded, taking it back to China and building their economy on that basis. They don't have to make that investment in R&D if they can steal it from us. And so this industrial espionage, primarily nowadays through cyber means, although not exclusively, some of it through humans, some of it through recruiting, you know, faculty members at major universities, they're engaged in a full frontal assault on our economic system and our technological innovation system because they're not willing to spend it at home. And then they subsidize it with low interest loans, with government money, and with a market system that's not a market system.
Right. And I'd imagine, you know, there's an element of being able to manipulate supply chains to their advantage as well, and making sure that we're not necessarily, you know, producing what we need to be producing. So, you know, we discussed defense tech startups, and we're thinking about the increase of defense tech startups. And you working, you know, in a venture capital firm that focuses on dual use technologies, could you give an example of a startup that's worked with the Pentagon and what lessons that we could take from that in terms of, you know, implementing that with other defense tech startups?
Sure. Look, I mean, what you've seen is you've seen a couple of young startup defense companies that have actually gained some traction, right? You look at large contractors like Anduril or Rebellion, right? They both had some success gaining long-term contracts with the DoD and establishing themselves in this larger dynamic of defense contractors. So that's, I think, a positive. You've seen the growth of two new large defense contractors, one more successful than the other. Anduril's been very successful. Rebellion's faced some challenges, but it's rebooting and it's going through some changes, right? And then you do see some of these smaller companies, right? Companies like Dragos, right? Companies like Calypso AI that are selling to the government, right? In these very forward-leaning, innovative domains in the cybersecurity space, you see Dark Web IQ, right? That's worked with the FBI to solve ransomware cases, right? So there are a number of companies out there that are having success with the government, but the question is, can they scale? And can the government make it easy for them to scale? Because at the end of the day, as a venture capitalist, right, we need firms that can scale up over time and over large amounts of money. We put little bits of money to work early on in very risky companies with a large payoff in mind. And so for companies that are going to the government to have venture scale, they've got to get into full-scale production with the government. If they have to jump through a dozen hoops to do so, right, that's the hard part. And so as a venture investor, what you really want to do for your government-focused companies is say, look, you've got to bake trust, safety, and security in at the outset, right? In order to get your product adopted by the government, scaled, and then you hope that the government's willing to, allow itself to buy that innovative technology and not let its own sort of buying processes and long-term commitments to other larger contractors get in the way of that.
So when you're thinking about software and the software produced by these defense tech startups, you know, that's what gives militaries the edge. And in order to capitalize on this advantage, we need to understand how the software is developed and how it interacts with the hardware in order to take advantage and, you know, really, really be successful in the next battle space. So what's your assessment of how well the Pentagon has figured out how to buy software, how to adapt it, and how it can be used in the battle space?
Well, I wish I had a good answer for you on that. Look, the Pentagon's doing a lot to innovate in the battle space, right? This idea of JADC2 or you know, whatever you might call that, the next battle space for the warfighter, the Pentagon's definitely leaning forward, right? And they're leaning forward in looking at how AI can be utilized to better serve the warfighter. That being said, it's not nearly fast enough. It's not nearly aggressive enough, right? The software industry, the AI industry alone is moving at a breakneck pace. And if you want our Defense Department to really keep up with the Joneses, right, the Chinese, the Iranians, the North Koreans, and the like, the Russians, right, they've got to innovate just as fast. Now, that's going to be hard, right? That's going to cause us to have to depart from our traditional commitment to large battle units, right, to large platforms, right, our commitment to large defense contractors who, frankly, just can't innovate nearly as fast. And some of them are better than others, and some of them are acquiring small companies to get better at that, right? But at the end of the day, you've got to be willing to buy from the small, innovative player. You've got to be willing to feel that technology fast. And at the core of this, you've got to be willing to fail fast and fail often. Defense Department does not today incentivize that. None of the government really incentivizes that well. But if you look at the days when U.S. industry and the U.S. Department of Defense has innovated most effectively, it's been in small units, it's been in new capabilities, it's been during the space race, when we didn't mind losing a dozen rockets on the launch pad to get one that made it to the moon, right? And we were able to even stomach losing astronauts on those launch pads. We didn't want that, right? We sought to avoid that at every turn. But until you're willing to incentivize people to take risks and are willing to promote them even when those risks don't succeed every time, right? That's the culture we have to adopt. And the Defense Department's been talking about that for a decade and a half. They haven't really adopted it. And frankly, neither has most of the U.S. government.
Right. So, you know, thinking about legacy platforms and turning to legacy code, you know, very, very little code is actually made from scratch. And I'd imagine that would create some certain vulnerabilities. So is there a way that we can ensure there's secure coding that is from scratch while still, you know, ensuring we do more secure by design and that sort of thing?
Well, look, I think we have to have software engineers that are trained to, you know, do secure coding and build in secure by design at the core of their platforms, right? And so to the extent that we can, one, train them to do that, right, early on, there are companies out there today, some of which we've invested in, that make a specialty out of training people to do secure code, right? And then vetting that code, whether it's AI models, right, or software, or just general software code, right? You want to be able to vet that code, make sure it's not full of vulnerabilities, right, and check it. You want to make sure the models are doing what they say they're going to do and not doing something different, right? So building and investing in capabilities that do that as well. And then finally, on the back end, checking that code, testing it in process as it's being deployed, right? That's another separate set of tools that are needed, and you need expertise to deploy those as well. So from birth to death of a piece of software and the engineers that are making it, you want them ensconced in secure coding. And that's why, as part of this effort that we've engaged with a number of defense tech investors, we've made a commitment to only investing in companies that build secure by design, resilient by design. You know, we've signed commitments in public, right, committing ourselves to that notion. And so when we vet a company, we go through the due diligence, that's what we're doing along with a number of our co-investors in this space, most of whom are dual use and national security investors as well.
And so does that secure by design, does that end up benefiting the investors as well?
It does. And so the beauty of this is, if you think about it, one, you want your code and your software to be adopted. Well, how's it going to be adopted? One, if the purchaser of that software can trust it, right, can trust that it's going to work and do what it says it's going to do, and that the users whose data goes into it or comes out of it can trust that data is going to be secure, right? And so to the extent that a piece of code is ultimately determined to be vulnerable, or data is able to be exfilled or modified while it's in state, or the AI models don't result in the results you expect to get, right? If that's what's happening, then the software's gonna be less valuable, less likely to be adopted, and less likely to make money for investors. So we believe that investing in trust, safety, and security in our software is a core part of our investment thesis. We believe it results in better returns for our limited partners, the investors in our fund. And so, you know, we've been doing this for the better part of two decades, along with a lot of our colleagues. It's only now that we've decided to put those commitments and principles in writing, but it's the way we've invested for two decades. It makes a better return for investors.
Right. And kind of going back to your original point, that sort of movement from industry is incredibly necessary in terms of setting the standard. So I want to shift gears a little bit and touch on semiconductors. Yeah. We're 2 years into the 10-year implementation plan from the CHIPS Science Act. So, you know, what are we doing well and what can be done better?
Well, look, obviously, we're putting some of that money to work. I think that the general sense out in public is that not enough money is being put to work. Too much of it is being spent on foreign companies who, yes, are building in the United States, but their allied companies, to be sure, but not enough being done by American companies. I think we want to see more in that space. I think we want to see more of that money being put to work. The American public is already paying the price at the gas pump, as it were, and in the form of inflation. So if we're going to pay that price, right, we want to see it actually be put to work and be put to work quickly and be creating American jobs. We find that, you know, environmental regulations and access to the kind of air, power, space, and cooling, the kind of water you need to run these facilities is increasingly challenged. So that's part of the difficulty as well. And so we need a more open regulatory environment if we're going to do these things, right? We're going to need to have that space as well. And then we, you know, let's just be candid. We have to be talking about friendshoring. Not all of this investment is going to happen in the United States. The billions of dollars that we've admittedly put to work for the CHIPS and Science Act are not nearly going to be all of it. We need our allies to step up as well. We need them to create permissive environments. And then we need to go fund innovation and development of semiconductor capabilities and other capabilities, critical minerals and the like, in those spaces as well. So it can't just be a U.S.-only strategy, but also can't be U.S. dollars only. We're not going to be able to spend nearly enough to keep up with the Chinese in particular. And as a general matter, we've made the decision economically to hand over manufacturing overseas, primarily to Taiwan, right? Who is, of course, an ally or a partner. I guess we can't say ally, a partner. But of course, they're also, given the U.S.'s theoretical one China policy, which is we've never really abided by given the Taiwan Relations Act, and the Chinese look across the strait, the Chinese Communist Party is looking across the strait and threatening Taiwan, that base is increasingly under stress. So we've got to get it out of there. That might mean places like Vietnam. It might mean places in South America. It certainly means some investment here in the United States, as we've been making. But you also want that to come with U.S. capabilities. And we don't have the STEM base we need this country today because we've let it wither away. And frankly, we've let it, you know, travel away because we bring the best and brightest of the world to stay in our universities, and then we force them to go home to their home countries, whether that's China or Russia or anywhere else, to build their companies. It's a crazy immigration policy, right? And the idea that we continue to adopt, and even knowing we need that talent here, we should be making these people part of the American dream. Nobody wants to build a company in Beijing or Moscow, and yet we force them to go back to those places because we won't keep them here because we can't get out of our own way on immigration.
Right. And so you've made the case really for moving with alacrity when it comes to semiconductors, but how can we also ensure that there's both functionality and security at the same time? Because that tends to slow down the process in a lot of ways.
Look, there's always going to be this trade-off between functionality, security, speed of development, and technological innovation, right? And I think the way we solve for that is we recognize, as we have as investors, that building safety, security, and trust into your systems, whether it's semiconductors or software, right, only benefits the sale of those capabilities, right? To the extent that you worry that your semiconductors are going to be corrupted or aren't made in a trusted foundry, the government's less likely to adopt them, right? Allies are less likely to adopt them. You want to sell to allies in the government? You got to build more effectively. That's another way the government can actually influence buying decisions and can influence security in the marketplace. All too often, the government thinks its only lever is regulation, right? Regulation comes with a lot of costs. If the government were simply to use its position as a major buyer of these capabilities, right, it could have a much more measurable, much more immediate impact on security, right? You look at what happened with the SolarWinds hack, right? Probably better to call it the Microsoft hack, to be honest. We've now, the CSRB has now revealed that, right? But in a lot of ways, if the government made a move away from Microsoft to other capabilities, right, you'd see Microsoft improving itself, right? Yes, it's now talking about improving itself, given the CSRB report that just came out, the Cyber Safety Review Board report, and there's talk at the highest levels of Microsoft about improvements. But if the government had pivoted away even a little bit, right, that money matters to companies like Microsoft, to companies like Google, to other companies in the marketplace as well. And so the government has a buying power capability. Now, it's not universal, right? It's not larger than industry, right? But it makes a measurable difference. And so rather than reaching first for the regulatory stick, as the government always tends to do, it might reach first for the contractual stick. And then second, it might reach for the incentive stick, right? Or the incentive carrot, right? The idea that people can get tax incentives or government contracts or government grants if they build trust, safety, and security into their systems.
So kind of on the same note, but then switching gears towards AI, when you think about our competitors, in particular China, when it comes to AI, they, you know, don't really have as much emphasis on the rule of law that we do. They don't necessarily care about any types of regulations. They don't care about the international system. They just want to win. So how do we sort of balance our rule of law culture and the system that doesn't necessarily, that actually plays by the rules while still ensuring that America's competitive when it comes out to AI development, when our adversaries don't necessarily do the same thing?
Look, we've always had that system you just described, and it's always been successful. So the idea that we need to abandon it to keep up with China, I think is not correct, right? That being said, we have to recognize they're going to pour in a ton of money. They're going to do it in an unfair way. They're going to steal our technology. They're going to put government subsidies behind it, like, and we have to treat them as not a fair player in the international marketplace, right? That's why I think the Trump administration had it right when it imposed significant tariffs on China, right? And frankly, the Biden administration has kept a lot of those tariffs in place because, in fact, China was never a fair player in the marketplace, whether it's for semiconductors or luxury goods or the like, right? They've never been a fair player. And so we ought to treat them as an unfair player until they become a fair player, if they can ever do so. And we have to pay them back. We have to punish them when they engage in large-scale IP theft. They've gotten away with it for a decade. They've stolen trillions of dollars in technology from the U.S., billions of dollars a year, and they pay almost no price economically or politically or militarily for that. And so until we start effectively punching back, and that punching back can come in a variety of forms, right, we're not going to succeed because they're not going to see a cost to engaging in business that way. And, you know, we all had this pipe dream. Look, I'll admit to being part of it. We had this pipe dream back in the 90s that if we just treated China fairly, they'd treat us fairly and they'd be a good player in the marketplace. We've let that happen. And look, it's one thing to buy T-shirts from China. It's a whole other thing to be reliant on them for semiconductors. It's one thing to be reliant upon them for critical minerals, right? We cannot allow ourselves to remain in that position. Pharmaceutical precursors. We all learned that during the pandemic, right? PPE, right? Masks, right? We all learned the benefit of the problems with that. And yet today, are we any better off on our PPE supply chain, on our pharmaceutical supply chain, on our critical mineral supply chain? The answer is no, because we don't want to make the choices it takes to mine in this country, to process in this country, and to make the kind of decisions we need to make to really build pharmaceuticals here either. We're just not ready to make those choices, and we're not really willing to put that with our allies either. So it's no surprise we're right where we were when the pandemic began.
Right. So sort of zooming out, when we think about the consequence of these choices that we're making, you know, what are the consequences if we don't win, you know, in terms of AI innovation? What are the consequences if we don't continue to invest at the rate that we have, you know, in semiconductors? Like, what does that look like? What are the actual national security consequences of not making those choices?
Well, look, I don't want to be, you know, crying out for like the boy who cried wolf, right? But the reality is it could mean the end of American supremacy economically, politically, and diplomatically, right? We have had the benefit of being the most innovative country in the world. We remain that today. People often forget that we are still the greatest nation in the world. We still are the greatest economic engine in the world. We are at the forefront of the AI revolution. People forget that because it's easy to get caught up in the negativity of a 2024 presidential campaign with two candidates who are nearly in their 80s and who all they do is talk negatively about this country and blame everybody in this country, whether it's big tech or the mean other party, right? They blame everyone. They don't tell the American people that we need to invest in ourselves and that we still are the greatest country in the world. And when you get in that mode, right, it's easy to believe that, right? But the truth is we're still hugely innovative. But that innovation is fragile. It can be gone tomorrow. And the Chinese and, frankly, our other adversaries are doing everything they can to get ahead of us. They're trying to get the jump on us. The only way we're going to succeed is to recognize that we are still the most innovative and that by investing in ourselves and investing in our capabilities and, frankly, by bringing the brightest and smartest of the world here to build companies here and keeping them here, making them part of the American dream, which, by the way, is how we built our economy for 200 years, right? That's the only way we're going to win. And until we recognize that and get out of our own way in terms of negativity, in terms of our political system, and in terms of our disastrous immigration policy, we're not going to win, and the Chinese will get the jump on us.
Right. And so, you know, one final question, which is playing off what you just said. You know, one of America's strengths is our spirit of innovation. So how does the future administration, how do future policymakers, how do they leverage that? How do they recapture the American dream like you were talking about?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. Number one, you've got to go to the American people and remind them that we are the greatest country in the world. You've got to remind them that we are at the forefront of the AI revolution. It's not China, it's not Russia, it's not Iran, it's not North Korea, it's not any other country in the world, it's not France, it's not England, right? And why is that? It's because this is the only country in the world, right? Maybe Canada too, but nobody wants to be a Canadian, right? Right? All Canadians want to be Americans, right? But the truth is it's the only country in the world where you can go and within one generation, you can be an American. You can't go to Germany and become a German. You can't go to Russia and become a Russian. You can't go to China and become Chinese, right? Even Chinese inside of China aren't, if they're not Han Chinese, aren't, quote, viewed by the government as real Chinese, right? And so the reality is this is the only place in the world where you can do that. It's why it's the only place in the world where people want to build their companies and build their economic futures. And yet, we get so caught up in the challenges of today that we forget that. So we need leadership. that reminds the American people that we can and are successful. But in order to do so, we can't rely on other people. We can't blame other people. We can't rely on the government. We have to rely on ourselves. That's what America's always been about. And we've forgotten that. We don't have leadership, not in either party today, that reminds us of that fact. Number two, if you're going to rely on the American people to rely on themselves, and you're going to rely on that to make us successful as an economy, we have to have the government get out of their way, right? We have to allow innovation to flourish. We have to remain in a low-tax, low-regulatory environment, right? And today, let's be honest, both parties want to spend like drunken sailors, right? They want to put us into huge debt. We're already $1 trillion in debt. We need to get our fiscal house in order, right? We need to prime the economic pump by cutting taxes, but that means cutting spending as well. And that will mean hard choices. That means hard choices about entitlements. This will not happen on the back of the discretionary spending. We have to make real hard choices about the future. We can't leave our children with $1 trillion debt for the future. That won't succeed. And so we need, once again, leadership that says that, that admits that, and recognizes that cutting spending while also cutting taxes and keeping regulations low is the way to economic success.
Well, I can't think of a better place to end. Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.